Today is Tuesday, December 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed praised his soldiers on Monday after declaring victory in Tigray.
Abiy said they'd carried out a special surgery in Mekele and not destroyed the city, nor killed a single civilian in the region.
Plus, Iran makes new accusations.
Ali Shamkhani, secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran, also told the country's state TV, quote, "This is a very complicated assassination that was carried out remotely with electronic devices."
We'll have these stories and more next. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed praised his soldiers Monday after declaring victory in Tigray, but leaders of the region's powerful TPLF say that they are still fighting. Reuters' David Doyle is up first.
The triumphant Abiy Ahmed praised his troops in Ethiopia's parliament on Monday for their victory in the country's northern Tigray region, even as the forces he claims to have defeated said they were still fighting. His soldiers captured Tigray's capital Mekele at the weekend, prompting a declaration that a military operation in the region was completed.
"The defense forces never killed a single person in a single town. No soldier from any country could display a better competence. We have disciplined, heroic soldiers."
Abiy said they'd carried out a special surgery in Mekele and not destroyed the city, nor killed a single civilian in the region. But in a conflict where information has been difficult to verify, the rebellious Tigrayan People's Liberation Front has a different version of events. It says Mekele suffered heavy bombardment. It also says the war is far from over and claims to have shot down a plane and retaken a town. In a text message, TPLF leader Debretsion Gebremichael said he was close to Mekele fighting the, quote, invaders. Abiy's spokeswoman has dismissed suggestions that fighting is still ongoing, saying the many delusions of a disintegrating criminal clique were not their focus. However, Debretsion's defiance raises the specter of a drawn-out insurgency against a battle-hardened TPLF that, from the days when it toppled Ethiopia's Marxist dictatorship nearly three decades ago, has known how to exploit its mountains and borders with Eritrea and Sudan. The violence, in which diplomats believe thousands have died, has also stirred ethnic rivalries. When he took office in 2018, Abiy pledged to unite Ethiopia's 115 million people. But ethnic clashes had killed hundreds and uprooted hundreds of thousands from their homes even before the latest bloodshed.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is continuing a push toward diversity as he rolls out more administration appointments. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani is up next.
Biden's announcing his senior economic team, highlighted by former Fed Chair Janet Yellen, who would be the nation's first female Treasury Secretary. He's also tabbing Neera Tanden to lead the Office of Management and Budget. She would be the first woman of color in that post, as would Cecilia Rouse, atop the White House's Council of Economic Advisors. Biden's picked her to chair the council. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Biden is preparing to take office at his inauguration as the 46th U.S. president on January 20th, 2021. He holds an unofficial 306 to 232 vote lead in the Electoral College, which determines the outcome of the U.S. presidential election, not the national popular vote, although Biden leads there as well by more than 6 million votes. The state-by-state vote in the Electoral College is set for December 14th, with Congress certifying that outcome in early January. Biden's transition to the presidency officially began last week after a government agency declared him the apparent winner of the November 3rd presidential election. U.S. President Donald Trump, however, is continuing his long-shot legal effort to upend Biden's victory, even as the president says that he will abide by the Electoral College outcome. Trump has refused to concede defeat while claiming, without evidence, that the election was rigged against him. Trump and his campaign have lost or withdrawn more than 30 lawsuits claiming vote and vote counting irregularities, but they are appealing at least one of the verdicts against him to the U.S. Supreme Court. Iran has called the assassination of one of its top nuclear scientists complicated, with a senior official saying on Monday that an opposition group, as well as Israel, were behind last week's killing. Reuters' Adam Reed takes it from here.
Iran began the burial of one of the country's top nuclear scientists in a cemetery in northern Tehran on Monday, with a senior Iranian official saying an opposition group, as well as the Israeli government, are both suspects over last week's killing of Mohsin Fakhrizadeh. Ali Shamkhani, secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran, also told the country's state TV, quote, "This is a very complicated assassination that was carried out remotely with electronic devices." That came after Iranian media also reported on Monday that the weapon used in the killing was made in Israel. An unnamed source to the English language station Press TV claimed fragments from the site where Fakhrizadeh was killed bear the logo and specifications of the Israeli military. In Jerusalem, there was no immediate reply from Israeli officials contacted for a comment on the report. Fakhrizadeh was killed when his car was ambushed in a spray of gunfire on a highway near Tehran on Friday. One Iranian outlet attributed it to a machine gun operated by remote control, while another said it was a weapon controlled by satellite. Israeli intelligence minister Eli Cohen told a local radio station before this latest Press TV report that he did not know who was responsible.
That was Reuters reporter Adam Reed. The British government says that it has agreed with France to double the number of police patrolling beaches in northern France in an attempt to stop people crossing the English Channel in small boats. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Nicolas Pinot in Paris over WhatsApp to get the details on the agreement.
Well, basically, the deal will see French patrols double starting this very Tuesday. You're going to have drones also and radar used to detect migrants trying to cross the channel between France and UK. The deal was signed on Saturday, and both Interior Minister Priti Patel for Great Britain and Gérald Darmanin for France said that they share the mission to make, and I quote, "a channel crossings completely unviable." We also have to notice that Britain pledged to give additional fundings to French, around $33 million, to help France's major efforts against illegal crossing. And this deal is going to be reassessed in 6 months to see if the measures taken work on the ground.
Nico, why the deal now? I mean, this is almost the end of the year.
Well, you know, there's an emergency to tackle the situation. Just to give you an example, last weekend, French patrol boats rescued 64 migrants trying to cross the channel. You had among them a pregnant woman, and you had children. The numbers of crossing have skyrocketed over the past months. For example, in 2019, you have just a little bit about 1,800 migrants trying to cross the channel. As of this year, you have 8,000 people, according to UK agency, who try to cross the channel. So the pressure is huge for both governments to tackle the situation. They really made the difference between the migrants, and they understand the sufferings and the fact that they're trying to start a new life in the UK. But also, they're explaining that behind the migrants, you have traffickers, illegal networks taking advantage of this misery of these poor people. And they really want to try to reduce and make the trip really impossible, to cut funding for those traffickers.
You mentioned that the goal is to try and make the crossing unviable. What's been the reaction from human rights groups and migrant advocates?
Both NGOs and human rights activists, they're claiming that both governments are overreacting over the question. And many of them saying that we need to tackle the issues. Why are these migrants trying to go to UK, to England? Basically, we need to fix the problem in the origin countries.
Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris, France. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said China's rise could be important, but also that it posed challenges.
China is investing massively in new weapons. It is coming closer to us from the Arctic to Africa, and by investing in our infrastructure. China does not share our values. It does not respect fundamental human rights and tries to intimidate other countries.
The Secretary General also spoke about Afghanistan, and reporter Catherine Field shared with me more of the details from the press conference via WhatsApp.
Concerning Afghanistan, this is a real problem for NATO. They've got to reorganize themselves ahead of a deadline next year as to whether to stay or leave. Of course, the problem is if they leave, then they run the risk that all of the gains they've made will be undone, that it will no longer be a safe country because they just will not have put in place everything to make it that way. If they stay, then the question is going to be, okay, who is going to man any mission there? Because you'll need new countries to come along and offer up troops and training. And who's going to pay for it? Because training, assisting, advising the Afghan forces is an expensive business. The other important point is China. And here, when the Secretary General was talking to the press, he made some very pointed remarks. And in particular, he said that he was very concerned about the balance of power, particularly with the rise of China. And even though he said China is an economic partner and there's issues such as arms control and climate change, which needs to be addressed, he said there are serious issues of human rights. And he made it also quite clear that when it comes to respect for human rights and living in a stable region, China's values do not match those of NATO members. So in the next few days, as well as talking with foreign ministers of NATO members, he'll also be reaching out and talking with Asian partners, non-NATO members, such as Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and South Korea. All those talks will be about China's actions in the region, particularly in the South China Sea.
Now, Catherine, the Secretary General's remarks are coming a day before the NATO 2030 report is being released. What exactly is that?
Well, NATO 2030 is a review to see how NATO can adapt in the future. You have to remember the environment under which NATO was born has changed. The range of challenges are different since the time of the Cold War. Nowadays, there is terrorism, economic espionage, cyber warfare, and NATO needs to adapt to that. It will need additional funding to address those needs. It will also need more funding to keep that technological edge, as well as having, you know, the old-fashioned nuclear defensive missile systems in place. So the other question is NATO getting too big? The question has been asked, and it will be addressed in this report. Has NATO expanded so much that it's now so difficult to get a collective agreement? Perhaps it's time to rethink collective defense and improve the political decision-making and maybe even give NATO a more political role as a sort of a linchpin of transatlantic cooperation. Now, part of the background music to that follows remarks you may recall from last year, President Macron of France, who accused NATO of being brain dead, by which he meant NATO had just failed to adapt to the changes, such as a more assertive Russia and China.
Speaking to me from Paris, France, that was reporter Catherine Field. And this is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Mark Hamill has paid tribute to Darth Vader actor Dave Prowse, who died on Saturday after a short illness. He was 85. Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker opposite him in the Star Wars films, tweeted that Prowse was a kind man and much more than Darth Vader, adding that he loved his fans as much as they loved him. Britain's culture minister thinks Netflix series The Crown should come with a disclaimer saying it's a work of fiction. Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden weighed in on criticism of the historical liberties taken by the royal drama and says he worries viewers may mistake fiction for fact. Kavan, dubbed the world's loneliest elephant, is ready for his journey to a sanctuary in Cambodia and the company of other elephants. After languishing alone for years in a Pakistani zoo, it took several hours to get Kavan into his travel crate, ready for his departure Monday. This is Hilary Fox with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Today is World AIDS Day, an annual event the United Nations has instituted to bring awareness to the suffering caused by HIV/AIDS and what is being done by scientists, governments, NGOs, and community groups to prevent and treat the virus. which the UN claims has cost between 32 and 45 million lives since it was first identified during the 1980s. Many AIDS victims are children who contract AIDS in the womb. A UNICEF report released last Wednesday cites mixed progress over the past year in terms of the effectiveness and widespread testing and treatment of HIV/AIDS among both mothers and their children. It is a challenge the COVID-19 pandemic has made more difficult. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Chouet Luo, UNICEF Global Chief in Charge of HIV/AIDS, to learn more.
We've done remarkably well in advancing treatment with antiretrovirals to pregnant women to reduce mother-to-child transmission. In Eastern and Southern Africa, for example, the most hard-hit area for HIV, up to 95% of women in 2019 access antiretroviral treatment to prevent mother-to-child transmission. But that is counter to what we are seeing in Western Central Africa, where access is just above 50%.
Why the huge disparity between Southern Africa and Central and West Africa?
There are many reasons. One of the things that is becoming clear to us is the quality of maternal child services. Having good access to prenatal care and having good access to postnatal care is part of the solution. One of the key reasons as well we see in West Africa is just user fees for services. So economic barriers to accessing healthcare. But we've done amazing things, mainly in clinics in Eastern Southern Africa, trying to advance testing at the community level using outreach services that we normally do for immunization. Women will come up and be tested as they bring their children for immunization. And that has worked well. We need to do more of it. And there are efforts working with churches and church facilities to popularize family testing. So there are solutions, but understanding the context is very important.
And of course, the COVID-19 pandemic is a complicating factor.
Now, with COVID, we're already seeing major disruptions in testing services, especially for children, because of the fear that mothers have about COVID, so they don't want to go to health facilities. But I think as we start to see the vaccine being taken up, maybe we'll see a convergence of testing for COVID and testing for HIV in children, and maybe these disruptions will start to go away.
A little earlier, you spoke about testing and treatment disparities between regions within Africa, but your report also cites testing and treatment disparities between mothers and their children.
85% of women living with HIV are accessing treatment today. That is compared to 54% of children 0 to 14 accessing treatment.
One might think that when mothers go to the clinic to get tested or treated, that they'd bring their kids along to get tested and treated too. But difference in dosage and the drugs themselves for the two groups makes that difficult. What is happening to make drug treatment easier for children?
In many developing countries, we've tried to work with pharmaceutical industry to make sure that we move beyond syrups because they're expensive, first of all, and it's not always easy to get clean water, but also refrigeration for formulations like that. But the good news is that increasingly we're getting the products that we need for use in the very young children.
I know there are some very promising same-day tests that have been developed and approved recently.
And we need to roll those out. And that's going to be a huge game changer. We're working with a number of countries to make sure that when these diagnostic technologies become available, we can quickly put them into the system so that children can benefit. Because with same-day results, we can actually initiate treatment immediately compared to mother comes in, take the sample, put it on a filter paper, post it out somewhere. Samples get lost, results don't get transmitted, and sometimes it takes up to 2 months before you get that result. There's an urgency. As a pediatrician, this is something very close to my heart. We have seen declines in mortality. We just need to do better so that we can save our children from dying of AIDS-related complications.
Dr. Chouet Luo is the global chief in charge of HIV/AIDS for UNICEF, and she was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. Speaking to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg during an online question and answer session, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, outlined five key public health measures that can be employed to help reduce the spread of COVID-19.
Uniform wearing of masks, keeping physical distances, 6 feet if you can possibly do that,
avoiding crowds and congregate settings, particularly indoors. And that means typical things like gatherings in restaurants, gatherings at homes, where people other than the immediate family unit are together. The other thing is to try as an extent possible to do things outdoors preferentially over indoors, with hand washing being the fifth thing.
The United States has 13.3 million of the world's 62.7 million COVID-19 cases, according to statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University. The World Health Organization also warned Monday that malaria deaths will likely exceed COVID-19 deaths in Africa because of the health care disruptions caused by the pandemic. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison is demanding the Chinese government delete a repugnant tweet of alleged war crimes in Afghanistan. Phil Mercer reports that the doctored image appears to show an Australian soldier murdering a child. It was shared by China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and follows a report last week that found Australian Special Forces had committed at least 39 unlawful killings in Afghanistan.
The image is confronting. It was posted by a Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Liang Zhao, and shows a doctored image, which portrayed an Australian soldier with a bloody knife next to a child. The child is seen holding a lamb. The text beneath the photo reads, "Don't be afraid, we're coming to bring you peace." Australian media reported the Twitter post appeared to be a reference to unsubstantiated rumours that elite Australian soldiers used knives to murder two Afghan teenagers. An inquiry into misconduct by special forces found no evidence to support the hearsay. It did, however, find credible evidence of unlawful killings by Australian forces in Afghanistan between 2005 and 2016. Last week, Zhao said China strongly condemned the soldiers' actions and that the four-year inquiry fully exposed the hypocrisy of the human rights and freedom these Western countries are always chanting. The fake picture posted online has infuriated Australia. Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
The Chinese government should be totally ashamed of this post. It diminishes them in the world's eyes. Australia is seeking an apology from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, from the Chinese government, for this outrageous post. We are also seeking its removal immediately and have also contacted Twitter to take it down immediately. It is a false image and a terrible slur.
Relations between the two nations were already frosty over allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic affairs, cyber espionage, and differing views on Beijing's military expansion in the South China Sea and democracy in Hong Kong. Canberra's call for a global investigation into the origins of the new coronavirus, which was first detected in China, angered the Chinese government. It insisted Australia was unfairly targeting China. China now appears to be using trade to pressure Australia. Last week, Beijing announced sweeping tariffs on Australian wine exports, which are likely to inflict huge losses on parts of the industry. China has also imposed restrictions on other agricultural commodities and coal from Australia. Analysts say the dispute over a fake photo posted by a Chinese official on Twitter will only inflame tensions further. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Twitter has suspended a Thai pro-monarchy account linked to a royalist volunteer program that a Reuters analysis found was connected to thousands of others created in recent weeks, spreading posts in favor of King Maha Wachi Ralalankorn and the palace. Brian Wood has this Reuters exclusive.
While not directly linked to the account, internal army training documents reviewed by Reuters showed evidence of a coordinated information campaign designed to target opponents and spread pro-monarchy messages on Twitter, an important platform for criticism of the government even before the protests. After Reuters sought comment from Twitter on Wednesday, the account, @Jatarsa_school, was suspended. It had gained 48,000 followers since its creation in September. The account's profile had said it trained people for a Royal Volunteers program run by the Royal Office. The Volunteer Spirit 904 program began in 2016 during the current king's reign to build loyalty to the monarchy. The palace did not respond to a request for comment. A Twitter representative said Sunday, quote, "The account in question was suspended for violating our rules on spam and platform manipulation." The spokesperson said it was not a result of the Reuters request. The Reuters analysis found that more than 80% of accounts that followed Jatarsa School had themselves been created since the start of September. And a sample of those showed that all they did was promote royalist hashtags. In early October, Twitter announced it had taken down 926 accounts linked to the Thai army for violating its policies by amplifying pro-government content and targeting political opposition figures. The army at the time denied that the accounts belonged to any army officials.
Reuters reporter Brian Wood. In Afghanistan's central Bamiyan province, women have enjoyed relatively more freedom than elsewhere in the country, but many are now facing an uncertain future. VOA's Aisha Tanzim brings us this story.
Bamiyan has become known around the world for its 6th century Buddha statues that were destroyed by the Taliban in 2001. It is also one of the few places in Afghanistan where women have been cycling in public, wearing modern clothing, attending classes with young men. In the last elections, it was the only province in which women voters outnumbered men. 18-year-old Shakiba Aryan understands that the freedoms she enjoys in Bamiyan are not allowed in most of the country.
Bamiyan is so good, the situation, and I'm very happy about this. In the first, also, the Bamiyan was not the situation very good. But by the time, now it is better.
These freedoms are a far cry from life under Taliban rule in the 1990s, when women could not leave the house alone, could not go to school, and had to cover themselves head to toe. After nearly two decades of war, in September, the militant group started official negotiations with a government team for a political settlement. Simultaneously, the United States announced a troop drawdown as part of its own deal with the Taliban. Many in Afghanistan think the militants have the upper hand at the negotiating table and will walk away with the lion's share of power. And the women in Bamiyan have started wondering how that might change their lives. Women like 23-year-old cycling champion Zainab Hedri.
I personally worry around 80% because since my childhood, I had a lot of freedom in terms of education and sports and my family. If the Taliban come back, they will stop women from cycling, as even right now, our society has a problem with women cycling. In terms of education, they have accepted to allow women to get education, but in segregated settings.
Many of these young women have grown up in a post-Taliban era. They have also lived in a province considered safer than the rest of the country. Tourists from other provinces come to Bamiyan for a respite from daily security threats. Born after the fall of the Taliban, these young women have grown accustomed to certain rights. And now, the possibility of a Taliban return to power, even if it's through a political deal, has created fear that they may lose all the freedoms that they've enjoyed so far. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Bamiyan.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Tuesday.